mainly in the past, in the 20th century.
Well, that is true to a certain extent, but it's still, of course, a term in Germany. I told you there is a famous YouTube, actually, movie, not YouTube, it's like a documentary about what the meaning of Heimat is to you. So they ask immigrants in Germany today, what is the meaning for Heimat for you? And then they answer, so this, the Heimat is this for me, that is that. Maybe I can show you online, actually, that would be interesting. Yeah, you could say it's something from the past, but by the way, you showed me that it's not.
Yeah.
You sent me a, Mandy sent me a piece of newspaper. Here's for my kids. And you can see my taste in music as well. Let me see. Actually, there's one on Sutirol that I also saw once, but I'm looking for a specific... this one.
That's the right.
Yeah, it's this one. So this one is actually, they're asking Turkish... there's another one, it's this is also very interesting. So they ask... can you see, sir? Can you
see we see, it? Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So they asked Turkish migrants, which actually came in the 60s, 70s.
As workers.
As workers. We're okay. Talking about, altogether it's millions,
yeah.
Until now. I can't hear anything. Can you hear something?
It's coming out somewhere.
Something there. So we came to Munich, the ones who said German?
I'm sure you can change the...
You
can't change the subtitles?
They said that they were very well welcomed
in Bayern. Mit dabei nur ein Koffer, ein einjähriger Arbeitsvertrag und die Hoffnung, in Deutschland genug Geld zu verdienen.
So they hope that they came only with one suitcase, with the hope that they will make some money. Ah, and there, of course, the contract. It needs always in Germany. You need a contract or anything. I mean, of course, yeah. No, but the question here for Heimat is, of course, it's the question of the two Heimats. That's the thing here. Basically, these people are coming from Turkey mainly.
Oh.
They're saying we have a Heimat there. We are coming to a new sort of Heimat, and then they're being asked, "What is a Heimat?" Now. This is one of the films, classically, I wanted to refer you to. There's another, actually, film which is even more pertinent. I won't find, maybe I'll show you it next week. I forgot to put it on, I wanted to. I have another YouTube short movie today, which is basically the Ein Fester Burg. Ein Fester Burg is the home of the Protestant... Protestant narrative, in a sense. It's written by Martin Luther already in the 16th century. We'll see it later. Okay, so this is basically it. Okay, any other notions of the Heimat?
Did you talk about how it is perceived today?
Hardly, not yet.
Okay.
What do you want to say about that?
I
want to
say that it's a controversial term nowadays. Kind of like it's being used.
Yeah,
okay.
We did speak about it. Yeah, yeah. But you can add. Yeah, you can add.
No, people say that it excludes from the society those who weren't born in Germany or with migration background.
Exactly. So this is why a lot of the times, you added. This is why a lot of the times it's you have films like this which involve newcomers to Germany, and they're being asked, what is the Heimat food? And then they said, you know, it's this, it's that. And usually a lot of the questions will be, well, we'll never really be integrated into here.
But what Noah said is it's excluding the immigrants, but in a way, if you see the word Heimat as birthplace, it's including the second generation. In a way, it creates if a Heimat is the moledet of the people shenoldu po, so they were born here, so anybody born here, regardless of race or religion, will still be included in that.
Yeah, but
the term is not just, it doesn't just...
I understand, it's not neutral, I understand, but it can be used.
They use it in a way to say that it's not just about where you were born, it's about your background and your origin.
Heritage,
exactly.
Yes.
It has some kind of a cultural load, one could say,
yes.
Right? A cultural meaning. Cultural is a very nice word sometimes to put some kind of, even I would say, some kind of racial interpretations to some extent. But it has a cultural for sure meaning, which means that it doesn't matter even if you're, you know, that you are born, you're three generations there, sometimes it's not your Heimat. This, of course, refers, one pertinent, very, very relevant example is Jews. I was speaking to Thomas this week. I mentioned the article by Gordon Smith in Britain in 1878, which actually is also the year where William Marr publishes the term anti-Semitism. The same year, Gordon Smith, who is also an anti-Semite, is actually a professor in Cornell at the time, who was born in England, and he's writing, Can Jews Be Patriots? So basically, it doesn't matter if Jews are 10 generations in Britain, the accusation of them not being legal or lawful citizens is still pertinent. It's not exactly like being the Heimat, but patriotism actually is a word. Well, that's another term we could unpack. Actually, it's a good question. What is the difference between patriotism and or being a patriot or being a national or nationalistic or whatever? Could one think of it different, by the way? Today, how would we understand patriotism?
As loyalty and to the land.
So first of all, it comes from what word?
Patria.
Father.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is actually, but the patria, the father, but they actually, it's interesting, but the word patria is very much engaged with the mother, land. Even though it's for the father, the signification...
Except
of,
in Germany, where it's the fatherland.
No, but also in Germany, there's the fatherland in Germany, but there's also the motherland in a sense in Germany. Yeah. Mutterland is also being used.
They use that?
Yeah, they use it, and also they use that for symbolization in picture. For instance, in Wacht am Rhein, which is a very famous song on the Rhine, they always use, usually the symbolization is of a woman standing with a shield and a sword. It's in many countries, the nation is being symbolized through the image of a woman. And actually the patria...
She is not the land, she is the nation. The land is a fata.
It could be both. It could be gender.
It's like Russia.
What?
Russia.
That is Mother Russia for sure. But no.
Also the Americans use motherland.
No. Also the but almost the English are less... but, okay, let's go again to patriotism against nationalism. Today, being a patriot is a bit less, less extreme and less radical in a sense. Okay, that is being the patriot.
Less what?
Less radical or extreme, at least in interpretation. Whether it is or not doesn't matter so much, but it's something that we need to take into just to account. By the way, going back to the Heimat, it has a very unique German understanding. But this is where the point where Corfino enters. Because for him, the Heimat is what? It's not only the nation, it's also...
The spirit.
The spirit as well, but another thing I'm looking for. And it actually speaks about in the chapter from last week. More than this week. This week is different. But for him, it's also...
The collective memory?
It could be the collective memory,
borders,
that's right.
The land?
Not the borders, but the region. The region itself. The region is a region. This is why Heimat is many times is a territory itself. It's where we make the you know, it's the where we are born. A really, you know, very, very good term for this actually is, if you want, autochtonos, autochton, being someone from the place itself. You know that word, autochton? I mentioned?
I did mention it.
It's very, it's a very
what
good
do you mean
term.
From the place itself? Like blood and soil?
No, like a native. From the place itself. Being autochton is like being a native in general. It's of course a Greek term.
Indigenous.
Yeah, indigenous Greek term coming from there. Actually been still used, I learned that it's still being used in Albania, where it's meaning that it's one who actually thinks that Albania should be a great Albania, including northern Greece, parts of Kosovo, etc., parts of Italy, there's greater Albania. So if you say, and northern Macedonia, by the way, parts of it. Anyway, those terms, Heimat has a very regional land meaning, okay, something which is there, but also, of course, also very unique. Not parallel in terms of it's not identical, but very much parallel to another very unique term that we mentioned, which is folk, of course. Folk, right? The term folk, again, it's also being used in other languages in a sense, but there, being folkish is actually going more to the folklore, okay, to something which is, you know, something
more cultural.
Cultural, less, and of course the folk coming already from Herder, even before to some extent, has a very much racial understanding of meaning. Now here's the complexity, because the Heimat has a tension, or if you want, the two branches. One is the very regional one, the territory of the region itself. Okay, the Wittenberg, if for example, Bavaria, Saxony, etc. That is one thing. Another thing which is very important here is actually the overarching term of perhaps all of Germany. Okay, what is the Heimat? And this also is very much connected to the question that Arndt asked in his poem. What is Germany? And those questions are embedded within the debates on what is Germany. Because we saw, especially today, it will be very much relevant. The discussion whether we need a Grossdeutsche Lösung or a Kleine Deutsche Lösung is continuing to some extent even after 1871. Why I'm saying this? Just think about Hitler. The Anschluss, of course. So you think on Hitler himself, yeah, as an Austrian. But it's not only Hitler as an Austrian. You think about the Nazi bureaucrats, I mean, of course, Eichmann and others. Austria is embedded within the German
Heimat
bureaucracy, etc. Now, why is this important? You understand that those debates on the German which is big and the German which is small are not going anywhere. Right? They are defining German politics also after 1871. So, in the fact, the question if Germany, if we are only sort of compromising on the Kleine Deutsche Lösung is not true. We are not. The World War One actually goes the same way. The fact that Austria stands by the Germans, or Germany stands by Austria, whatever you want to take it from, but it's mainly Austria standing by the Germans, because without the Germans there's no war to that extent. Austria will not go to it alone in the stand where she was there, especially since it's becoming weaker and weaker, right? You think about this, these questions are not going anywhere. And the question, again, what the Heimat is, okay, what is our Grenzen, our borders, where should we stop Germany, do we think about this, a larger Lebensraum, where is this, are not going anywhere. Okay, we have some kind of solution in 1870-71, but the question is still there.
So it's what, they see it as temporary?
It's a question of temporary. It's somewhere in the imagination of the land. I don't know if temporary for sure. Every empire, the European empire in the 19th century, especially if you're Italian or German, when you don't have enough, you would think about expanding. The thing is, and that is always the problem, you cannot expand so much to Africa and other places And also, actually, you cannot really expand into Europe. But that does not bother them sometimes because they expand. They expand. This is a very, very crucial thing. And of course, question of identity. So whether we are Protestant or can we be also Catholics within our borders, and then also the question of Austria comes. How could we take into us so many Catholics, perhaps putting in jeopardy the Protestant majority? Right? That is a
question. So they have a contradiction there that they have to somehow solve.
Actually, they never solved it. That's just the thing. It's never been solved.
By separation of church and state.
Yeah, that's true. But, well, separation of church and state to some extent, at least formally, is already from the Augsburg and then Westphalia agreements.
Yes.
Where we say who is the ruler, he defines the religion. But that is not actually a separation. That is because if you are the ruler and you say what the religion is, it means that state and church are together. But religion and state are together, you understand? But there's some kind of more equilibrium there. Yes, Mandy, you want to say something?
In the first page of Mein Kampf, Hitler write that the most important thing is the unity of Austrian and Germans.
Mm-hmm.
But this is his idea. What is the correct definition of who is German? Because Bismarck claims others.
Yeah.
So what is the correct...
Yeah, in this sense, Bismarck was, as I told you several times, we'll see it today, also to some extent, Bismarck was a very rational, pragmatic leader. So for him, and this also meant actually very cruel deeds sometimes, because internally he wanted to be very harsh against the Catholics and the Poles, expelling 32,000 Poles in 1885, for instance, and Jews. By the way, Poles and Jews who sort of did not have rights to stay where they are, but of course, it's not, you know, rights are also a very deep debate, I would say debateful or argued concept. I mean, what do you mean by rights, okay? Yeah, so, this, but in terms of expansion, and also into Austria, Bismarck, I don't think Bismarck wanted this, but not at all. He wanted the small Germany, because he understood very well that the meaning of this will be actually jeopardizing his own Protestant majority within the land. Now, again, Confino brings a very complicated picture, because as we'll see by the liberals, the question is not actually sometimes only on the notion of Protestant or Catholic, but more has to do a lot with your political identity to some extent, okay? The liberals are actually taking upon this stance and marking Sedan Day. We'll deal with this in a second. Now, importantly, another concept, and Arik said beforehand, is this term of collective memory, of course. Now, the Heimat really plays into this, okay? He has some kind of a collective memories narrative, which is promoted through it, to the region, to the place, you know, to the land itself, etc., etc. And that is also the problem, because collective memory has another side, and that is forgetfulness. So nations, and this is following what Renan said in his marvelous lecture, What is a Nation? 1882, you heard about this lecture?
Yes.
1882, who did not hear about this? Renan, 1882. Marvelous lecture, qu'est-ce que c'est la nation? So what is the nation, basically? And he basically claims there that the nation is a daily referendum, if you want. Okay, each day people need to claim or to want to belong to that nation. I'll tell you in a minute why he said it. Importantly, to that aspect, is that Ernst Renan, the Frenchman, also claimed a very beautiful sentence, saying, nations also need to forget. Okay? It's not only about what we remember, what it's we also forget. About what we forget. Now, why do they need to forget? And unfortunately, some nations do not forget too much, and they need to forget more. They need to forget because only if you forget, sometimes you can
move on,
keep on, keep going on. Now, it's not like, and there's a difference here. Do you repress the memory, right? Like in psychology, or do you? Yeah, exactly. You, and there's a, you know, there's two. There's forgetfulness if you want after there's a closure, some closure. And there's a forgetfulness without closure where there's some kind of repressing the memory. And actually then it's never forgetting. You know, a very, very relevant example is the Armenian genocide. Interestingly, I would say that if the Turks would have acknowledged the Armenian genocide, it could have been already part of history. In a sense. Now, what's happened with it, it's actually the other way. Because it's not been acknowledged, it's been there.
The Shoah was acknowledged and it didn't become part of history.
No, you're right, but there's a big difference in that. The Shoah, the fact that we can have here a German flag, usually, I don't know what it is today.
Yeah. I understand.
A German flag here, a part that you can move on. You're right, in some instances we're still stuck there. It's okay, and it's understandable why, okay? It's a horrific episode, but the wound, I wouldn't, you know, it's a big, it's hard to say today, but the wound is not as open as it could have been without having an acknowledged Erziehung process by the Germans. By the way, I have plenty other examples for this in any nation's life, okay?
I think the Germans maybe it wasn't really a closure that they reached. I think it's a different type of...
Again, who did not reach a closure?
Like with the Germans and the Jews. We said it's either you repress something and it stays hindered, or you deal with it and reach a closure.
Yeah.
And I think the Germans, like, they try to frame it as... They did this, what is called, like, coming to terms with the past, which I think it doesn't reach just closure. Like, it stays present, but not in a negative way.
Yeah, yeah. Closure perhaps is a too harsh.
Like, they didn't forget.
Yeah. Closure is a too harsh word, but by the closure, what I mean is basically, you can say it's like coming to terms with the past. I mean, I don't know what, you know, closure. It's a question, it's a big question. But anyway, what I want to say that it's a different sort of kind of those things are... anyway, now that's different than forgetting, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Okay? But sometimes you need to forget. Now, again, there's forgetting through repression. But that repression of memory, I don't think that really works. Not to human individuals. Perhaps it is. By the way, it is sometimes. I don't know, it's a big question. I'm not a psychologist. But what I want to make here, much more of a claim here, that in terms of collective memory, these things play a big, big part in how the national narrative is being defined and so. Yes, Mandy, you want to say something?
I just remember the deputy foreign minister of Romania.
Yeah. God bless his soul. No, I'm just kidding. Yes.
May he rest in peace.
He said that every country who now in a fight with Turkey recognize the Armenian genocide.
Yeah. No, I mean, When I say because the Azeris are always in you know, always faithful, what will happen to all these people when the Azeris now they also want to come here, so all of these people could be in jeopardy when they come to different. No, it's a horrible, the whole thing. The whole thing is a political
nightmare.
You're right. He didn't want to talk about it, but actually he was wrong, in a sense. Because his policy and his government's policies, if you ask me, I didn't confront him with it at the same time, but his government policy is actually to repress the Armenian genocide. But what they don't understand is the whole raison d'etre of Armenia, in a certain extent, comes from the diaspora. The diaspora will never let it die. They
need it for their identity.
Yeah, of course, not an identity. It's a matter that it's too big to repress, so you know they can, you know, do some things to not to speak about it. But these things don't go away. They don't go away. I mean, I have plenty of examples. Think about China and Japan, and the whole, you know, and South Korea, and Korea's not South Korea, but Korea and the World War II, the memory of Japan, you know, et cetera, you know, all of these examples. That is very okay. So forgetting memory. Now we spoke a little bit about the history and memory thing and what is the difference between them. I spoke also last week a little bit about Pierre Nora, Lieu de Mémoire. It's basically, did I speak, you remember Nora? Did I mention him? Pierre Nora, Realms of Memory. He had a really, really big project in France of actually bringing the memories of France into one very collective book. It was a big, big work in the 1980s. Since then, there's explosion in memory studies. All of the countries actually have some kind of a memory project. Again, some countries do not want to speak about very difficult things in the past. By the way, they're totally wrong with that approach. Totally wrong. Again, it's very similar to human.
How is that different than? But you just praised forgetting and maybe even repressing memories.
I'm rephrasing. There's one kind of forgetting which is done through repression of memories, okay? There's one kind of forgetting which is actually done through some kind of, I call it closure, and then forgetting, which is two different things.
Okay.
Now, big traumas, it's hard to do this without a process of some kind of inertia with the other sort of people there. Okay? So that is what I mean. Okay, good on this. No. We come here to 1871. Now, 1871, to a certain extent, I can use, and also actually Confino uses the word of Stunde Null. Now, is Stunde Null Bresser or not? That's a big question. Do you all aware of the concept of Stunde Null? So basically, we are talking about in 1945 is basically a new beginning. A new beginning of...
Schatz-Effes,
yeah.
Okay.
Schatz-Effes, so basically it's a new beginning, a carte blanche, I don't know any other term you want to use. Yeah, you understand? Everything starts from zero. We are recalibrating our history. Again, very artificial. And when you think about it, this is a way that you want to forget, of course. When you recalibrate your history, in a sense, you want to forget or you press some kind of memories. Now, again, sometimes it's very much needed. You need to forget some things. I'm claiming that on big traumas, this is not possible. In a sense, there's no one unified history as well as memory that could be common to all Germans before 1871. Okay, because we have these splits within the Germans, mainly splits that are going back, or divisions that are going back to the Napoleonic Wars. Because the Napoleonic Wars, even though they happened 60 years beforehand, okay, or finished 60 years before, roughly before 1871, right?
But the outcomes, 65 years. But the outcomes were still...
First of all, yeah, the aftershocks are there. This is like, you have to understand, the Napoleonic Wars are world wars, in a sense, okay? They are transforming the European scene, even the global scene, okay, even the global scene to a certain extent, redrawing the map. Indeed, the monarchic or conservative order is back, as we heard 2 weeks ago, but we have a backlash that we have a revolution. Again, a conservative backlash to a certain extent, but the conservative, it's all like a dialect, this is a very dialectical process, actually, right? Because we have a conservative, if you want, liberal, clashes throughout the 19th century. I'm not a Marxist or something, and I'm using the dialectics, but what I'm saying is you can see that there, and eventually, and all the time this kind of compromises, like you think you're going back, but actually going forward, in a sense. What do I mean by this? 1848 should be a setback, but as we showed and I claimed, it's not a setback, because it gives the push to the national definitions of Germany and Italy and other states, by the way, and the Hungarians. 1867, the Ausgleich. Okay? So we have this sort of going back. So it's very, very tensioned, dialectical, and going forward. And what is happening here, you are trying to do, and this is also very much similar to our history here, but also to other places, everything is being told or seen through what I called last week as a teleological way of view, okay, through the telos. Telos in Greek, the end. So basically everything is from that, and of course it's a very historical way to approach history. Because everything is being seen through the prism of 1871, which is totally false. It's a historical process. Because, for instance, it tells us that Prussia should have led was always the leader of the German project. Of course, not true at all. Okay? Indeed, a great force.
But no one was. So
no, to a certain extent, no one was. But, you know, Austria could still claim to be much more dominant historically than Prussia. Prussia very much dominated from the 18th century, but what was Prussia? What was Prussia before the 18th century? It's not, in a sense, I wouldn't say nothing, okay, but not a significant power, even within the German sort of lands, in a sense. A power, but not a significant power, okay? Austria, to some extent, was always there, rather significant, until it's really weakening there. And not only Prussia-led project, a Protestant-led project. Meaning that from 1871, everything is being read through a Protestant Prussian lens. Okay? Is that understood? And this is how you actually construct memories. Hence why the great Erich Hobsbawm had a very good title, catchy one, The Invention of Tradition. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Okay, invention of tradition is a very, very important term. Very important term, the invention of tradition. He has even a collector.
Who made the term?
Erich Hobsbawm, a Jewish historian, Marxist Jewish historian, died at the age of 96, a decade ago. Erich Hobsbawm, very, very prominent scholar. One of the great historians of the 20th century, without a doubt. Working in Birbeck most of his life, Birbeck University. Actually born in Alexandria, but a native of Prague. Okay? Hobsbawm came with the idea, the invention of tradition. So it's this constructive element where nations, especially during the 19th century, not only, also still in the 20th century, are inventing traditions. Now when you say invention, there is a big question, there's a big debate. What do you mean by invention? Do you mean fabrication, or do you mean some kind of a kernel of truth, which you tell a story around it, which gives it much more of an impact?
By tradition, you're talking about stories, narratives,
I'll give you an example.
Ceremonies.
Okay? I give you an example. In that volume of Invention of Tradition, I have it, I think, in my office. Should have it in my office. Very famous. It's with another historian by the name of Ranger, Trent Ranger, I think it's with him. He writes there, there's a series of monumental chapters. One of them is by the famous British historian, Hugh Trevor Roper. Okay, and then Trevor Roper writes there that the kilt, which actually you see in Braveheart, you know the kilt from Braveheart? Okay,
yeah.
Like your shirt. It's like so the kilt is basically was never in Scotland before the 17th century.
Really?
Yeah, by the way, that's true.
They came up with it in the 17th century. Why would they? They were wearing pants before.
Yeah.
And then they said, "Nah, that's a good bad idea."
Actually, they wore, or at least very.
White
trousers, I think.
Okay.
It's like the Jews, they wanted the Mahdi to come for the... No, that's it. Okay, anyway, but Richard Rupert, this is just an example, says this is an invention of tradition. Now, of course, for instance, you see a movie like Braveheart. What do you mean? It's already in the 14th century, right? The Braveheart is occurring under William Longshanks, which is at the end of the 13th century. the beginning of the 14th century. Robert the Bruce, the king, of course, our hero, what's his name? From Braveheart, not Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson,
the,
was
not the real hero. I remember it in a second.
William Wallace.
William Wallace, of course. So William Wallace, you see there, you know, in Sterling, you see the statues, you see everything. But that is an invention, okay? Now, states...
I'm sorry. Is that a fact?
That is a fact.
They didn't have kilts?
They didn't have kilts. This destroyed your wig?
What?
This destroyed your wig now?
This is destroying me, yeah. Because why would someone come up with kilts after...
You know what nations...
And it's tribal. They have their tribes and their different patterns.
Many. You know what nations invent in order to justify things that were never there before? You know, okay. I can think of 10 inventions a day when I walk in the streets of this land.
Okay.
No, every nation does this. It's not something
ridiculous. I understand,
ridiculous.
But that's something ridiculous to invent. If you invent that, there was a hero.
They did that.
If you would invent Wallace, so great. So that I understand.
No, so, okay, I'll give you another
invention.
You
understand King Arthur.
I'll give you another invention of what supposed German land fighting against the Austrians in the 15th, 14th century, even beforehand, is, of course, Switzerland and William Tell.
Yeah.
I mean, William Tell... It's a national narrative, legend, whatever you want to know. We don't know if a person is even more than Wallace. Wallace, we know, existed. William Tell...
We don't know?
We don't know. If you want another one, I don't know. You can go on with these inventions. The bottom line is this, the construction of sites of this, which are called invention of tradition. Now, every nation does this. The Germans did it like other nations. What is the invention of tradition in their case? In their case, it's this kind of getting a very, or telling us a new story from 1871 to some extent. Okay? First of all, it's a story of success, expansion in war, limited expansion, and especially drawing borders, trying to make a monolithic new project, which will be based on a Protestant as well as a Prussian, if you want, dominance. Okay? And for that, you are telling us, or I would say, constructing new notions of identity. I spoke last week about the relations between religions and nationalism. And I also mentioned football. Remember? So we have holidays, rituals, what else? Holy...
Places, temples, okay. Temples.
We have, if you want, we have customs, mitzvot, sacraments. By the way, also in nationalism, okay. We do have
some sacraments. Do you have in nationalism?
I'll tell you what sacraments. You come to class. You don't do this here, and you sing the anthem every day. The kids come and sing the anthem.
Yeah, yes.
I don't think that's a sacrament.
Pledge allegiance.
That is, of course, a sacrament. It's a ritual, sacrament, and...
It's a ritual, yes.
No, it's a sacrament as well. It's a sacrament.
Sacrament is something that has to be done by some kind of a priest, by someone
No.
Someone who's what's the word?
You take the sacrament...
Musmach.
No, you take the sacrament as a... Think about it as a mitzvah, okay? Not a sacrament.
Right.
No.
Sacrament specifically is like the Eucharist or the
first of all also the I agree I know what you mean but we also have our priests. The teacher in the class in that sense is the priest. Okay, she tells the students, the people.
You mean in school?
In school, yeah.
You're not a priest.
You are the priest.
Yeah, you're not a priest.
Yeah, I'm
sacrifice
hardly,
by the way also.
I'm hardly the
But also sacrifice.
What do you mean sacrifice?
The next one, okay.
Sacrifice for the nation.
Sacrificial, yeah.
Of course, sacrifice for the nation. Michael Billiger referred you to that book, Banal Nationalism. Why would people want to die for a nation? By the way, it's a very good question. If we'll ask it more, I think all nations in the world will have a big problem.
Yeah.
The problem is that human beings, unfortunately, do not ask this question enough. It's a very stupid idea when you think about it. God forbid I'm not, God forbid I'm not for a second mocking any fallen soldier ever. What I'm saying is, if you speak about...
Wrong with the wind.
Yeah. When you think about it philosophically, not only philosophically, it's a very stupid idea.
Would someone die for his family? Is that stupid?
No, that's not stupid.
Why?
That's a different thing.
Hell.
That way, because your family, you know. But what the nation does, if you go to imagining...
If you never
imagine communities, we think that everyone in the nation is your brother and sister. Now, I tell you the fact, not everyone in the nation is your brother and sister.
Right, but your family is part of the nation. I mean, I agree that seems a bit of a reckless idea, but to a certain...
Reckless degree, is a good way to put it. It's very, no, it's very mild. It's good, I like it.
But your family is part of the nation, so I do see how
it's
some...
part of... Well,
how some people would see dying for your nation as a great...
Wait, but here I ask you a very philosophical... Is it really part of the nation? It's part of the nation. Since the 19th century, people told you it's part of the nation.
What was a nation? It's a nation that it was a tribe, and it was a name. It's simply a matter of perspective. I'm not defending
it,
I'm just
arguing. It's a very good argument. It's a good argument, without a doubt. But it's a matter of scale.
Yeah.
Now again, I'm just putting this forward that you think about. I'm not saying necessarily that I oppose every sacrifice for the nation, etc. I'm just saying, think about the idea.
I don't think the people went today. When I went to Lebanon and when my son went recently to Gaza, he went to protect people he knows.
Yeah, they convinced him that the people in his squad...
No, people he knows, people, me. He went to protect me or his sister.
No, I'm not, again, I'm not...
I understand. I'm not pushing back. I'm saying people think, at least in some cases, if the nation protects the individuals within the nation... If that's what happens, if the very existence of the individual is relying on the nation, assuming that is true.
Okay. That assuming
is true. So anyone fighting for a nation is also fighting for each and every individual within that nation, which includes his family and his more extended family and his friends.
In some respect, you're right. But in others, you're wrong.
This is the first time that in some respects I'm right, so, yeah.
No, it's not the first time. It's the second time.
Okay.
No, but you know what I mean.
I understand.
I'm going to a very, if you want, epistemic.
I understand.
Understanding or knowledge of what we think is right for... things that we think are natural, and they're not natural enough. Now again, yes, no, that's the thing. But we have to acknowledge this, that such kind of sacrifice is something, first of all, I would say rather new in history, because of course it always happened. In the mass phenomena that it is rather new. Okay? Because when, for instance, Argos fought against the... Sparta, okay, or whatever, you know, you have a very localized community, everyone is an oikos, like a house, okay, belonging to a tribal...
Samula.
Yeah, and that is very understandable, right? It's something which is almost natural in a sense. Here, this expansion of these masses, that's a new thing. Right, wrong... And also, you have to remember, for many centuries, the notion of mercenaries...
That's what I wouldn't understand. How mercenaries...
You don't understand, but look at Russia today. If there's no mercenaries, there's no Russian army.
But they are forced. They are forced to fight. Also Ukrainians.
No, first of all, they are forced, but they are being paid rather well for them. I saw the stats.
They're not going to die for...
I don't know. I don't think...
For money.
But again, I don't think ideology really plays a central part. That's from outside, I'm saying. Perhaps it is a very crucial point. I don't know. Anyway, okay, so we spoke about these parallel points, religion, so on. This construction of an idea or reconstruction or, I would say, invention of traditions are very powerful during the 19th century, while nations are becoming a crucial part of the way we see and understand the world. In that sense, nations are a new phenomena. And I would even go further than this. I would say that nationalism, following Ernst Kellner, invented the nations. So the ideology...
What invented the nations?
Nationalism. So ideology...
So first the ideology came and then the nations.
Then the nations came. That is what Kellner says. That is it true or not true? It doesn't matter. But that is one way to see it. Almost, in my mind, and there's no question it's a modern phenomenon, the way we see it. That is my interpretation of it. By the way, you can argue differently. I mean, many people do. Saying that, I mentioned this, we have made Germany, now we must make Germans, okay? Again, paraphrase on the saying of the Italians, okay? But this is a problem, because you have this regional disunity, like in the case Confino speaks about in Wittenberg. And there we also have a very dangerous memory, right? And we spoke about this a little bit last week. And the counter, if you want, the counter narrative towards this, we'll see it in a second, is actually memorizing or commemorating the Day of Sedan. The Day of Sedan, what was Sedan, who can tell me?
The fight between Germany and France.
1871, actually.
Yeah.
I think it's 71, this Sedan.
70. That's
maybe it's 70? No, is it 70 or 71? It's a crucial. The war finishes at 71. It's 71 Sedan, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But the war goes for 2 years. Basically, it finishes at 71. What's important there? It's the crucial fight between the Napoleonic Third Napoleon, and the Prussian
1870.
Germans. Sedan? Okay. The war finishes at 71.
Yeah.
Anyway, what's crucial here is the commemoration of that day as a memorial day, like we do again in religions. Okay, we take a day, you need to find yourself a new narrative, and think about it. Rise, for instance, of Christianity.
No, the first time they celebrated it was the year after in 1871.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That was the first celebration was 1871.
Yeah, but the
day itself was the year
before. That's also.
That's why the confusion.
That's what is confusing, right? But the battle itself is 1870. That's true. A very crucial battle between this is actually the decisive battle between Germany and Prussia. By the way, following it, there's also a siege of Paris, in which tens of thousands of citizens, and that is a rather new, I'm not saying citizens, of course, did not die before and wars, but it was very, really exceptional in this war. It was, by the way, a very bloody war, around 200,000 casualties. So we're talking about, if I'm not mistaken, 40,000 Germans, and I think more than 150,000 French.
In Sedan?
Not in Sedan, in the whole battle, in the whole
war.
Yeah. In the whole war. The Day of Sedan, I don't know the casualties. Sedan is a very crucial moment, but it's not the end, what I want to say, it's not the end of the war. They still have a siege on Paris, where the casualties are citizens. By the way, another important fact is that the Red Cross, this was one of the first initiatives of the Red Cross. I think this was, you can count the fourth one. The first one was, by the way, a Battle of Solferino is 1859. Mm-hmm. That is a battle between Austrians and Italians. But there it's only when they are invented. There's no Red Cross. But you see them, for instance, in Schleswig-Holstein, where we mentioned, 1864. In 1866, the 7 weeks war between Austria and Prussia. And in the war between France and Germany.
140,000 dead.
Yeah.
On the French side.
On the French side. So I wasn't wrong with the numbers.
You weren't wrong at all. 44,000 on
German side. So basically, we're talking about almost 200,000 casualties.
Casualties includes wounded.
Now,
that's
this
another.
Is... Now, you have to understand what... It's also a question of memory and how we memorize, actually, the 19th century. We also say we have a story we're telling that the 19th century was rather peaceful. Now, of course it was rather peaceful when you think about World War I and World War II. But then you have to think, okay, but then there's a Stunde Null in the 20th century, and there's more peaceful times in the 20th century. And the whole, it makes you think about the whole thing of even delineating history according to centuries. Okay. In any case, we have a very big complexity here, where we have a national memory which is competing with regional ones. Wittenberg, as we saw last week, is fighting by the side of Napoleon, also because it's a rather dominant Catholic identity. It's fighting on the side of Napoleon I, I'm not talking about Napoleon III, in during the Napoleonic Wars, which makes things very problematic, because we have a so-called unpatriotic or against the national narrative, some kind of an entity working against the national narrative. By the way, same memories apply to other entities within Germany to some extent. Bavaria, for instance, problematic. I mean, it's by chance again that it's not, perhaps with Austria, perhaps independent, I don't know, because of Catholicism. So what if they speak German, in a sense? Right? And to some extent. And that's something which is very, very crucial here. And this is why it's important. You have to. This also tells us a lot about Germany today. This kind of a regional, unique identity to different to the different regions. So you keep local institutions. It's not only institutions. You go today to Germany, for instance, even in Berlin. You who lived in Berlin here ever? You did, mm-hmm. Right? When you go to Berlin, what do? The first step.
Anmeldung,
very good. You know what the Anmeldung is?
When you go to live there,
you have to register.
Yeah,
exactly. That is the Anmeldung. When you live or you leave. What do you mean? When you go away or when you live?
But actually, you can.
When you stay.
When you stay, yeah.
You're right. You do the Anmeldung.
Oh yeah, I did Anmeldung 40 years ago.
No matter where you live, now.
Mm.
That's how you find yourself doing the Anmeldung in like the farthest away Bezirk in Berlin.
Okay.
You can actually do it everywhere now.
So that's a new thing, I didn't know about it,
yeah.
but actually...
I live in Kreuzberg,
yeah.
But I can do the Anmeldung in a different...
Bezirk.
Yeah.
That is a new thing, and actually it ruins my point a bit.
Yeah.
But anyway, my point was that the regional identity is also within the cities themselves.
Right.
So each city has like a local township almost. By the way, in the past, Charlottenburg, all those areas were villages, sort of dissimilar to Finchley in London, but actually there, it's much more of a regional identity.
You mean like the city in London? You mean
expanded?
Yeah. No, all the neighborhoods,
yeah.
that used to be,
yeah.
Little towns.
Exactly. So they swallowed them in a sense. My point is that the regional identity is rather strong, not only between the federal states, also within the cities themselves, okay? The borders are clear, you know, it's like here, you know, I don't know, border between Bet HaKerem and Chagok HaJavel, we know where it is, but it's not like something which is really, you know, stated. But there in the past, in the Berlin, if you lived on that street and on that street, you have to do the Anmeldung there. And you have your own local sort of representative, in even political one, of course, in your region.
It's like getting a parking permit in Tel Aviv or Givatayim on,
yeah.
Two sides of the road.
Yeah. Okay, so we have that thing. That is something about the regional. Now, you have to put all of that mixture into a new unification process. That is then. The next step is, of course, the construction of new ideas, symbols. Now, you keep some of the symbols with the old, and that is a very clever thing to do. You keep some of the local identity before. You do not ruin everything. In some parts, they did ruin, because if it's not towards their agenda, for instance, Catholic symbolism in Germany. But to a large extent, you do keep some kind of symbolism, local one, but some kind merge it with a national story. Okay, that is the point again. Another actually point which is very important is how Breslau became Wroclaw. You all know, of course, that Breslau was a major city of in Germany.
Yeah.
Pomerania,
part of Pomerania?
Schlesia. Part of Schlesia. Of course. There's a book by Martin Tom, How Breslau Became Wroclaw. There you have an erasing of public memory, public institutions, public statues. You have what we call a statue side, if you want.
A statue?
Side. Like a genocide, yeah.
Yeah.
So basically it's like the ruining of statues, okay? Memories, erasing of street names, okay? How Breslau became Wroclaw, that is a very, very important point. But it's a point where we have two entities, which are Poland and Germany. After the war, they want to make Breslau their own Wroclaw, so they do this kind of erasing process, which comes with a new identity. This is not the case here. The case here is, okay, you do erase something, but you do keep some kind of local institutions intact, okay? Now, some kind of background about Wittenberg. The main city, of course, is Stuttgart. Wittenberg today, by the way, and Baden-Württemberg, which are combined today in the regional identity, one of the most rich state or federal
states. They were different in the past? Wittenberg and Baden-Württemberg.
Were they less rich, you mean?
No.
Were they different? Yeah.
Different identities?
Yeah.
A little bit, yes?
No, separated. Yeah. Separated. But coming.
Two townships.
But no townships. Regions.
Yes.
See the map behind me.
Zebra.
I can't understand. All the class, this is what's happening behind
me? So Wittenberg was the white and Baden-Württemberg was the black.
Yeah. I can't understand. The whole class, this was behind me?
Yeah, we were just looking at a zebra.
Okay. Who needs PowerPoint when you have zebras?
Actually, a zebra does look like Germany before 1870.
No, I'm looking here, speaking to a nice... you know how many slides I changed?
You changed slides there?
Yeah.
Oh. Так я гид машина, да? На имя вот и мало.
And most of the money now is from like the car industry. So it's interesting if there were...
And now there's actually less money from the car industry.
Yeah,
that's a problem.
Yeah.
We have the zebra. Oh.
Did you see this slide?
No.
We see this slide.
You see that slide? Yeah. No?
We didn't see it, no.
You didn't see anything?
And it's like 20 minutes a zebra. I never looked at a zebra so long, even when I went to the zoo.
I give up now. Okay. Maybe I should adopt the idea, showing zebras behind me.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, okay, so Wittenberg, some kind of background. You see the map behind me. You see the separation with Baden, of course, back there. We are speaking about most of the population is Catholics, Protestants. We have substantial but not demographic majority of the Catholics. Very important to several aspects for the Swabian identity, very sort of peculiar. Fighting on the side of Napoleon, we were the first, of course, during the wars. Very important in terms of monarchic dynasties. So basically also for the Holy Roman Empire, by the way, a very important place in that sense. And very much sort of a kind of an alliance with Austria. So we have two very problematic memories. First of all, fighting on the side of the Austrians in the Seven Weeks War. Another thing is fighting by the son of Napoleon in the Napoleonic Wars. And also even not, and that is the problem.
Who fought?
The king, the monarchy, basically, or Wittenberg, if you want. Now, here's a very important point. One could say, okay, Bavaria could fight on one of these sides because perhaps they have a majority of Catholics. In this case, it's even more problematic because the majority is Protestants, but still the fighting is on the Catholic side.
Yeah.
Against what is... You know, historically, is the Protestant
heartland.
Heartland, not heartland, but they're fighting against the Protestant sort of major powers in this situation. Okay, now a very, very important slide is this one. It looks rather messy. I don't think it's very messy. I think it's really, really clear in terms of what happens between 59 and 1871. Now, by the way, why does it open in 59? That is a question. But especially, I would say, first of all, these wars that Austria itself has been engaged with in places like Italy. Okay, that is the first thing. So the Battle of Solferino that I mentioned before, that is a major, major issue there. And here you see sort of the two paths that are going until the unification. So on the one side, okay, if you want to make a very complicated, it's a very, you know, we try to put into graph a very complicated story, but just you can remember this through this. So basically we have Greater Germany on the one side, which is Austria, including Austria. On the other side, we have the Kleine Deutsche Lösung. The Zollverein, which we mentioned last week, is basically custom-free area, is going historically with the Prussian side. Okay.
Why is that?
Because it's much more of a northern entity, and also has to do a lot with the free cities. Okay, those are all of those sort of kind of understandings are embedded into the to economic structure. Okay, of the northern lands of Germany. Okay, south you can divide in. Wittenberg, by the way, is really geographically is almost in the middle of Germany. Well, middle south, but sort of middle.
Okay. Also west.
West for sure. Yeah, middle south west.
Oh, middle. You mean from up there, from top down. Yeah.
And then we have several sort of events. So the German-Danish War we spoke about. By the way, we have a very important notion of the breakdown of the Frankfurt Assembly, which is, it's already an assembly which is being redrawn after 1848, but then totally crushed down in 1863.
I'm sorry, maybe I'm asking a stupid question, but what was the Austro-Hungarian, the Habsburg interest in all this? What was their interest?
Their interest is actually to keep the empire, first of all.
To keep their own empire.
Yeah.
So not to unite Germany.
Well, it's a question.
Because it can't go together.
No, they did want to unite Germany to a certain extent.
With Austria?
With Austria.
And what happened to the Hungarian?
No, they wanted to under Austrian leadership. But as a matter of fact, they were mainly struggling after, in those areas, mainly to just keep things rolling for them. To put a very complicated story.
No, what I'm asking is Prussia and Austria, to my understanding, it's not dualism. Prussia's interest is to create Germany under Prussian control,
leadership,
whatever the word might be, while Austria does not have that, I think.
And
the Austrian monarchy, at least. I'm not talking about Austria.
I don't think they don't have it. I think they have it, for sure. I mean, 7 weeks war, that's part of it. For sure they want, they could have, it's not too feasible for them, in a sense. They have, again, they have their own weaknesses after 48. Embedded weaknesses, especially after 48.
Yes.
No, but there's a question between what you want and what you can do. If they want, they want it.
Okay.
If they could, that's a bit different question. Okay,
what's the right way to try to absorb this?
It's look at it as a right column, a left column, of course, and then the middle is the clashes between themselves, or some kind of cooperation even, or break of cooperation. If you understand?
Trying to figure out.
No, it's not. You're right. It's not.
Uh-huh.
Me too.
No. So basically, okay. So basically, you have offers to reform the German Confederation and then Greater Germany. This is totally Austrian agenda. Then you go across. You have Lesser Germany and some kind of Zollverein Prussian-led project. And then you have the war. Okay.
Yeah.
Then you have. Okay. So this is the German-Danish war where they stand towards the war, especially.
They say what?
Towards the war. Okay, so they would, in the German-Danish war, they would go, we want a greater Germany sort of project, Here that would not, include
here
Den-
they're not,
inc-
not confronted.
The Greater Germany would include Denmark?
Yeah.
That's
Denmark
that's,
is Schleswig-Holstein, not Denmark.
Okay.
Schleswig-Holstein. Okay, then you have...
Schleswig-Holstein is the one beneath Denmark.
Yeah, okay.
I think what's missing here, that more time tags. I mean, okay, 1864, we understand it was the war. Well, then Austria brings an action against
Prussia. This is just before 1866.
So when did
this
that
leads
happen?
To 1866. This is just
so
before the
1865.
1866. This is just before the war. I can't remember.
Okay.
The, I can't tell you the exact date, but this is just before the war. You're right.
Okay.
That's the date is there. And then we have during the war some kind of alliance with Italy. That is a of Prussian Italy. They are because they see the Austrians as a major. Already from 1859, they see themselves as a very sort of...
France is neutral there.
Yeah.
Okay, and then what happens there? Austria excluded from Germany.
So
what does that mean?
So basically Austria on the side following the war is... The cut is final.
Okay.
Who creates the cut? The Austrians
the Germans,
or the Germans?
Because they win.
Because they win,
then,
yeah.
The cut is final.
Okay. Then.
Okay.
Ah, and then Prussia founds
the
North
German,
German
Confederation,
okay.
Exactly. And then you go to, you know, it could be more just a very crude sort of...
Okay,
and then
the
you, go, you go to the France, to the, you know, the break of France. Okay, that is just basically just putting those very important 10 years.
Yeah.
Just maybe it makes more, less order than... Now maybe perhaps you're more confused.
No, now I'm less confused.
Okay, good. No, just to picture that.
But I'm sure I will be more confused if Benny could see.
I'll make sure of that.
Questions, yeah.
Yeah. No, but this just makes things just to know, you know, just to put things into some kind of context. Okay. Importantly, by the way, here we have a image of the Sedan Day, of course, in Berlin, in the Brandenburg Tor. Where the Sedan Day, you know, is being celebrated, by the way, only until 1919. That is the last time the Sedan Day is actually being celebrated. Okay? It's no longer there. It's a thing.
Why? Because there's no point celebrating after the loss?
To some extent, yeah. It's the loss that makes it, absolutely. They lose Alsace-Lorraine.
Yes, so
lose,
everything is reversed.
Everything is reversed, in a sense, you're right. This also, of course, puts the seeds to the very problematic years of Weimar and also, of course, the rise of Nazism.
Yes,
okay?
and
without a doubt.
And stab in the back.
Okay. But anyway, what's important here is that the war really creates a new narrative of unification and of a national identity. So national identity, unified one, which was not there before, through events like the Sedan Day is being imposed, if you want, and also celebrated by on the Germans, in a sense. The problem is that not all Germans really celebrate Sedan. That is the question. And it doesn't have to do necessarily with religious differences, but as we see in the chapters,
with regional memories.
Regional memories, and also political identities, but also political identities which are linked to the region.
To the
liberals in Wittenberg. They are the ones celebrating Sedan Day. Okay?
This is a photograph, by the way.
This is a photograph, yeah, because this is a rather late...
it's not 1870.
It was 1870. By the way, there's always... They're already photographing in 1870.
Yeah, there was, but
yeah.
It's kept so well.
Oh, but this is a...
It's photographs in 1836.
Yeah. Okay. Just a little bit on politics. Here we have the major, if you want, figure within Wittenberg. The Deutsche Partei is the major, one of the major liberal parties and one of the major, most dominant parties there. Another very central party is actually the Catholics, which is the center. They are... In the beginning, they are the rivals of, in the Reichstag, they are the rivals of Bismarck. But then he understands throughout the Kulturkampf that he cannot diminish them or actually destroy them. And he actually eventually neglects the idea that he actually makes them even their allies or partners during the 1880s. that is important in terms of German politics. Very much elite-oriented politicians, okay? The guy or the man you see here, the guy, is Hermann von Mitternacht. Mitternacht, you know what it is, of course?
Middle of the night.
Probably because, I don't know, he was working the nights, so I'm just kidding. His ancestors were, that was a profession, a very powerful man. It's like the Bismarck, if you want, of Wittenberg to some extent, ruling for around 30 years there. But, as I said before, it's an enduring struggle between the solutions of the greater Germany and the smaller Germany. Those are not going away. They are still sort of tearing apart Germany. And this is a very, very important argument, because as I said before, it does not go away. It does not go away. You see it certainly again on the eve of the Second World War. By the way, one could even claim that you see it afterwards to some extent.
Absolutely.
Not in the sense that they want to eat Austria, but the regional identity and what is exactly Germany, etc., etc., and what we should include in Germany, not, I think it's an enduring sort of, even, well, today you can say no, well, it's perhaps a bit, little bit gone, but I'm not sure. The strife between forces still today, between...
Ah, very good.
I was speaking better.
I think maybe now it's less.
Yeah, sorry.
I think maybe now it's less about the territory, but returns to like the identity.
Yeah, it's about the high. It's a where Christopher. It's less of, you know, for us not incorporating Germany, but the question of even how does East Germany relate to the rest? It's not the same as kind of Georgia, but I think. To a certain extent, there's continuation here, okay? It's this kind of a mixture of identities, which was never, in a true sense, really brought together.
There are still parties in, also in the West and in East Germany that, like, it's very, like, minor, but they want to go back to, like, the separation.
Yeah, exactly. You had a phone call, Benny.
That was enough time to the Khelavari,
No, you had a phone call. I had to.
Really? Did you answer?
Yeah, I did, of course.
Did you tell her, you know,
it was the,
everything's fine?
It was the professor from Mandro. It was the professor from Monday.
Really?
Yeah.
I think it's the guy who invented the kilt. He's angry at me.
Anyway, okay. Sorry for that. Okay, so anyway, an enduring struggle about the greater Germany and lesser Germany solutions. And here is very interesting because you have differentiation between the Reichstag elections and the Landtag elections. So Landtag is the, basically the regional parliament house. Okay. The differentiation is very, very important because it's like a bit here you understand between the municipal level and the state level. Sometimes you see difference, not always. You see these differences sometimes, but then you have to understand it. It's a very, very difficult process to make a nation, in that sense.
To make what?
To make a nation, to break these identities, these memories, these things in the center. And then we have what we can call a clash in identities, sort of, of an idea. Because the liberals in Wittenberg, as you all read, I hope, and if you didn't, please go to there, actually being accused as having some kind of partnership with the Prussian.
Why are we focusing so much on Wittenberg?
Well, because it's a study case.
It's not something
study.
Special about
the case study. Sorry, it's a case study for. It's a case study for the understanding of the. Construction.
I understand of the clashing
national,
identities.
Yeah,
but it happened elsewhere as well. The same.
No, because that was the issue that they were
Catholic and they were
Catholics. They fought with the French, etc.
I understand.
So they were an extreme case. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, and they also try to, through this day, create this new identity.
Exactly. It's a very good example, if you want. Again, each place is rather different. Here, that's why Confino is focusing on this. We have this very problematic memory. And you have this problematic memory of a regional identity that needs to be important or glued into the national construction. And again, Landtag and Reichstag, what is very, very important there is the case where, while in the Reichstag you see that cultural, religious differences are having impact in the results. So for instance, if you are a Catholic, you will vote for the Zentrum. Zentrum is the party, the major party of the Catholics. But it's a possibility that you are a Catholic and for the local elections you will vote for the liberals. I'm just saying, it could happen. Okay? It did happen. It did happen. Okay? Just for an example. And why is that? Different agendas to begin with. Different understanding of what is Germany. How do you represent itself in terms of this whole conglomerate? Okay, where are you in terms of this? Okay, and reckoning your local identity as a Wittenberger, if you want. Okay. So the liberals will be identified within Wittenberg as part of alliance, or as having some kind of alliance with the major Prussian leadership or Germany now, hence working against the interests of their own people. For that matter, they will pick on the Sedan Day and make it their glory day and try to impose it. And they are actually the only ones who even celebrate it to some extent. Now, by the way, we'll see next week, we'll speak about the Kulturkampf. The Kulturkampf is crucial to understand this differentiation between identity. Now, my supervisor in Oxford, you read his article next week, he wrote an article, Oliver Zimmer, he wrote an article about actually how the Kulturkampf was not as bad as we think it was to some extent. Because we think of a very binary division between Catholics and Protestants. That is true. It did happen. But he shows how Corpus Christi, it's the celebrations of the, there's a Corpus Christi day anyway, the processions, okay? You go in the street, usually with, images, you know, very sort of display of Catholic symbolism, if you want, okay? And it'll show how also Protestants or Catholics are actually engaged together in this Corpus Christi. So basically, even celebrating today. So it's not as, Santa is not as binary as we think, but the Kulturkampf in general is binary. It's Protestants trying to really repress the Catholic identity. By the way, this is another example of not such a constructing a binary vision between Protestants and Catholics, because here, within Wittenberg, that is not the main thing. The main thing is the regional identity, how that is perceived. Okay, we have the general identity, but then we have also the regional identity. That is important. Here, just the quote from Confino itself: "Renounce in their own fatherland, Wittenberg, and be helped neither to the Empire nor to Prussia." So basically, we want you to stay with that identity. This is a Prussian. I think it's even Bismarck. I can find it to you. I actually have to add it. "For one is not loyal to his Heimat is unreliable, wishing only upheaval and revolution." So basically, he uses Heimat as the regional, immediate regional identity that the person there is identifying with his own region or regional space of Wittenberg in this case. Okay, so you cannot take it. Actually, it's a benefit for us. We want them to have that, so long it doesn't undermine the general process for unification of Germany. Okay, is that clear?
Yeah.
Good. Here we have, for instance, this case. Well, this is a famous, rather sort of famous clash here. But of course, we see on one side
Bismarck.
You see it on the. You can see
yes, yes, we
the
see.
The zebra is not there.
One side Bismarck, the other is
the Pope.
Yes.
It's the Pope. They have a very big clash. As you can see, I can't know if you see the chess players are actually...
Chess pieces.
Chess pieces, yeah, not players. The chess pieces are some kind of images of local powers within...
Kings and queens.
Kings and queens within Europe. We have this chess match between Bismarck and the Pope on the Kulturkampf. Bismarck's in the first decade, we'll speak about it much more less next week, was to impress the Catholics. A very, very important process. But importantly to our case today, the Sedan Day is actually not a celebration of religious identity within Wittenberg. Again, it's a celebration of the liberals within their, first of all, own identification with Wittenberg, but also their identification with their whole country. That is important. But, of course, excluding Jews, Catholics, social democrats, if you want. Okay? Liberals, by the way, of course, are the most national, I would say, promoters of the national idea of Germany, in general. Okay? This is why always I say liberals and liberalism in the 19th century is not how we understand liberalism today. We have to understand this. It has some commonalities, but it's not the same thing. Okay? And they are very, very chauvinistic, racialized...
Monarchists.
Monarchists, no.
Constitutional monarchists, yes.
Constitutional, some of them, depending on where you understand, but no monarchists at all. Republicans. Or constitutional monarchs.
Constitutional monarchs.
No,
right?
But they will be, most of them will be Republicans in that sense. Not. But mainly, and this is important, we as Wittenbergs cannot focus on the past because the past is very dangerous in that sense. Yeah, it's a foreign land if you want, is the following the saying. It's very dangerous. If you follow the past, we won't be part of the German, because then everyone will remember.
It's
no,
too scary. It's,
you know, we associate with Napoleon, we associate with the Austrians, etc., etc.
So they want to forget that or have it forgotten.
Yeah.
What?
Overwrite it, yeah. To do a sort of a new narrative. So that is one part of it. The other part of it, it does not totally disengage with the past. You can't really do it. It has some local... No, but it depends with which past. It's like selective past. And in that sense, memory is a selective process, of course. Okay? But you can also indoctrinate and maintain several sort of ideas that will be crucial there. Now, just another quote, and this actually brings us this one and the next song I'll show you. At the Battle of Sedan stood a man, Bismarck, who since then took charge of the Kulturkampf. The Kulturkampf is a historical challenge, and it is therefore the duty of all of us to guarantee its success. Of course, again, you will have to remember that the other side doing the Sedan War was, of course, France, and France is, of course, a Catholic entity. Very important notion here, okay? Very important. To remember. Now, not least important is this idea, before we go to the Kulturkampf next week, Ein Fester Berg ist unser Gott. This is actually a very famous song by Luther, Martin Luther. And in this song, he actually speaks about the... It's a very actually local song in a sense, because a Burg, you know what is a Burg is? Town, it could also actually mean, in a sense, it's not a book like Hamburg, it also means a citadel in that sense, not a citadel,
a castle.
It has the there's a, of course, association which is a physical one between the castle and the town because
it was built around the castle.
Yeah, and so it's a walled. It's a exactly a world. That's why I put your picture beforehand. You saw that.
Krach.
Yeah, something like that. Arim mukafot chama azu. Okay. And here he says this. This is Martin Luther. He says this, and I'll show you. I'll have a group of German singers singing this in a second. And he sings this, and the words are this. And first Burg ist unser Gott, and gute wären Waffen. So basically, he speaks about that this. Our stronghold of a citadel is our weapon in a sense. It has good weapon in arms, right?
What is unser Gott? What
is our God?
Who is our God? What book is our God?
A stronghold of a city, a strong or strengthened city.
So God is a strong city for us.
Yeah.
No.
A strong city
is our God.
But okay.
A strong,
it's not that we are praying to a strong city.
It's almost an allegory to the community in a sense, or the stronghold of the city is our God. Okay. And why I'm reading this in general? Okay.
Gute Will und Waffe.
Er hielt uns frei aus aller Not. So basically, it makes us free and provides us with all our emptiness, not as a something which is missing. Okay. I can't find the word in English now, but okay. Die uns jetzt hat betont, that basically we engaged with or we found with. Der altböse Feind, so basically the old
enemy. Evil enemy.
And who is that?
French.
Or Catholics. Okay. This is the Catholicism actually, because this is Martin Luther. Okay? Mit Ernst erst jetzt meint, so basically with Ernst. I'll find the word. So with Großmacht und viel List, which we basically power and it's an anachronistic word for
we make a
vigor, I think, if I put it correctly. Sein Gaus im Rüstung ist, auf Erde ist nicht seinesgleichen. So basically, there's nothing like this in the whole Earth, our orange. And this became the national anthem of the Protestant identity within Germany. Again, the Catholics, but against reproduction, reimagine during the Kulturkampf, which we'll deal in next week. Now, just
but
finish
not,
this.
But it wasn't an anthem of any state.
It was not a religious, it was ideological, if I would say.
Who would sing this anthem?
The
Protestants.
The Protestant forces in the war.
No, I think in the in regards to Confino's article, like in the Sedan Day celebrations, they would sing these kind of songs. And
yeah.
Say this kind of thing to exclude the Catholics.
Exactly. You're right. I didn't mention that. You're totally right. That's, in the Sedan Day, this, if I didn't mention it, you're totally right. I don't know why you can't hear anything.
The computer's muted.
So what do I do now? It's Hanukkah.
I've noticed there's no black people there. Just noticing.
I was thinking it's a pretty fancy church to sing.
For the Protestants, actually.
Yeah.
It's a Protestant church?
It's a good question.
I don't think so.
There's
no.
Like a Catholic
church. Many Catholic churches in Germany became Protestant, but they still have all the.
But they would get, if they became Protestant, they would get rid of the. It's part of the. No, they would get rid of all the statues.
They wouldn't.
It depends when it became Protestant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, I mean.
Yeah, and the mother became Protestant recently?
Yeah.
Anglican churches look Catholic anyway.
What? Anglican churches are kind of.
They're about as close to Catholicism as Protestants get.
Yeah. They're not really Protestants, are they?
Sure,
do we consider them Protestants?
Yes. Because they don't recognize purple colors.
I mean, how do you call the guy, the purple guy?
Canterbury.
The Bishop of Holy.
It's a woman,
What? It's a woman
it's
now.
It's a woman now.
Gewaldi Schlegel. I once saw him arguing with a TV show with the Monty Python guys, after Life of Brian. Very famous.
Anyway, you understood the point.
Uven Nimal, Optimit Zoni Paret.
Next week, next week, Kultur Kampf.
No, next week there's nothing. We have to give in the.
In the papers? Okay.
Why not wait for the next week, for the week after? I mean, on the eve of our Lord's birth.
You can have another week.
Yay!
You can have another week. Yeah, sure.
I sort of forgot we had to do that. That's helpful.
You can always ask, it's okay.
If we're not coming in, so...
In my BA classes, they always ask, and they can't believe I say yes. Of course you can do it. It's less work for me. I mean, it's more time for me to...
Also you'd like another week off.
I don't know, but it's a question.
Toda.
Sure. Chag Sameach, everyone.
Chag Sameach. מה, מה אתה רוצה לי?
מה?
תגידי, נועה, כמה זמן גר בגליל?
בסך הכל שבעה
חודשים. זה הייתי שם אחרי תקופה. למדת שם?
סיימתי שם את התואר שלי, ו...
זה היה חילופי סטודנטים או שזה היה סתם?
כן, עשיתי חילופי סטודנטים ונשארתי
שם. תודה רבה. ביי ביי.
נתראות.
ונשארת
שם? עוד ללמוד? או סתם?
לא, עבדתי.
סגור את האוטו שלי, תזכרו.
סליחה
שאני
מעיף
אתכם
ככה. אין מה, אין מה. לא, אז לא הבנתי, נראה לי שהייתי איזה חודש, חודשיים. לא קלטתי, סמסטר, משהו כזה. ממש גאות שם, אז באמת הגרמני. נתראות, עודד.
ביי, ביי.
ושנה שעברה הייתי שם כבר חצי שנה.
מעלית. איך הולכים למעלית, אתה יודע? איך הולכים למעלית? עודד. למעלית, איך מגיעים? מיד פעם זוכות. עשה, שני הולכים?
כן.
נתראות, ביי, נועה.